just in time. Head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all. Superman.
Good Wednesday afternoon, everyone. Hi, I'm Rob Snow. It's great to be with you and great to welcome back for the healthiest hour on radio, taking any and all health-related questions. Dr. Barry Dworkin, great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
521-TALK, 521-8255. That's 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 is a free phone call if you're on Bell Mobility. And we have a free long-distance call as well as 1-800-580-CFRA. I want to start by talking about obesity-related issues.
Okay.
Have you ever recommended to anyone that they have obesity-related surgery? Gastric bypass, is that what it's called? A gastric bypass?
Bariatric surgery.
Bariatric surgery.
Because there are different types of surgery, right? There's bypasses, there's banding, there's different ways to approach trying to reduce intake and also to bypass parts of the intestine which are associated with the development of diabetes. And I think we've talked about this before, Rob.
Sure, yeah. Sure. And, you know, I've had actually, you know, arguments with Yoni Friedhoff here on, mm-hmm. on the radio that I think that there's this prevailing opinion that if you have a bariatric surgery, mm-hmm. that you're taking a shortcut, that you're not doing the exercise or putting the effort in or mm-hmm. changing your lifestyle, you're going under the knife.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Yoni completely disputes that, and I trust his expertise,
yeah.
and he calls it life-saving. It's a life-saving surgery.
It is.
You agree with that?
I agree with his viewpoint. You have to remember, bariatric surgery is done...
Is it a last resort kind of thing?
Yeah, well, that's... You know, there are indications for procedures, and so you don't just jump to surgery as your first choice. Usually people are... evaluated on the basis of whether they have attempted to lose weight, if they've done pretty much everything they possibly could to lose. And sure, some of our listeners will say, well, people just have to stop eating. Well, that in itself is not not as simple as you think it is, because obesity, and as Yoni has mentioned, obesity is a canary in the coal mine type of phenomenon. It's a reflection of all that goes on around us with regards to our environment, with regards to our lifestyles, the food that is available, the type of foods that are available.
Right.
All these things are contributing factors.
You know what, though? There is this opinion out there. I don't know how prevalent it is, that it's like getting a boob job. You know, it's cosmetic surgery.
It definitely is not cosmetic surgery. The evidence is such that you will, let's deal with it on separate issues. From a medical standpoint, What you will note with bariatric surgery is that it essentially cures diabetes. Your diabetes disappears. Type 2 diabetes pretty much disappears within days to weeks afterwards. Hypertension goes down. Heart disease rates go down. Depression, osteoarthritis, liver disease, kidney diseases, risk of stroke, sleep apnea. The list is endless. All just to choose one of those conditions and the cost of trying to treat that. So we may deal with the secondary aspect of it.
But I guess what I want to get at is, are you treating the underlying and original causes of that simply by performing a surgery? If the patient doesn't change the lifestyle markers that caused those problems in the first place, Are you running the risk of having to go through that again?
When you do the surgery, again, there is a vetting process.
Okay.
And the person that has the surgery is also, there's a lot of explanation of what is going to be expected of them after the surgery. So after the surgery, you cannot just resume what you've eaten before. In fact, the restrictions are sometimes permanent in terms of what you can and cannot consume. Hmm. So the person has to be under that, has to acknowledge and agree to that. And my experience has been with patients who have had the surgery is that because of the selection process, they are motivated to do this. They have tried everything.
Do they
already.
Have to pay for it? Or does the government cover it?
Some of my patients prior to the government blocking people from going to the U.S. had it covered. It's now covered in Ontario. The problem is Ontario is only doing about 2,000 to 2,500 surgeries a year.
Okay.
And there are over 350,000 people who have indications for doing the surgery. So doing the math, you can see how long it will take to correct that problem. But getting to your point about whether people reverse their habit or reverse their behavior.
Their lifestyle.
Usually you do not see them counter the surgery.
Right.
They respond well because, and Rob, this is also very important, they see the result. They see what happens, how much better they feel, that they don't have to take their pills anymore.
They don't want to go back to the person
they don't want to go back
before,
there. Right. So that in itself is an incentive, and it saves the system a tremendous amount of money over the long term.
So let's talk about, because lap band surgery is in the news this week. It is officially called laparoscopic gastric banding.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an inflatable, adjustable strap wrapped around the stomach, curbs a patient's appetite, and limits how much food he or she can eat, thereby leading to weight lost.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the news because new research would suggest that this comes with a very high complication rate. What do you think?
With surgeries, especially for bariatric surgeries, and the type of surgery being done, the experience of the surgeon is extremely important. With new types of techniques, depending on the centers that they looked at and the techniques that are applied, new surgeries or new approaches usually are fraught with greater complication rates, just as coronary bypass surgery 20, 25 years ago was more complex and had more complications than coronary bypass surgery or open heart surgery is today. So the experience of the surgeon and of the institution in providing those services is ultimately what is important. For example, there are some bariatric centers in the U.S. where their complication rates or death rates are about 1 in 1,200 to 1 in 2,000 surgeries, whereas there are some in Canada just on the basis of limited experience, not because of incompetence, but limited experience, where those rates are 1 in 75 to 1 in 200.
Which is a study published in the Archives of Surgery,
right.
They point to a modern country like Finland, where you have complication rates as high as 40%. I mean, almost half of people who have this have complications.
Right. And so it's important to then determine what were the causes of that. Is it specifically for in that country where the technique is being taught or the experience of providing the surgery, or is it that this surgery inherently is more risky than some of the other surgeries done for gastric bypass? We don't really do lap band surgeries in Ottawa. It's usually bypass surgery that is done, and complication rates are usually much less. So, you know, again, it's always in some ways buyer beware, and also doing your research to find out what the complication rates are in that institution that you're going to, because this was an average.
Mm-hmm.
Some may have much better rates, others poorer, and that's what you want to use your basis for comparison.
Okay. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. All the phone lines are available if you have any health-related questions this afternoon. That's why he's here each and every week to take your calls, and we encourage you to call right now. Just want to bring people right up to date on a developing story that we are following. It's from Dwyer Hill Road, and I gather there is a pretty big grass fire underway in Dwyer Hill Road right now. They got 50 firefighters and about 15 trucks on the scene right now, and so far it's consumed about 20 acres. So, I mean, we're talking about a pretty big grass fire, and they're just undergoing what they call a burn plan, which would sometimes mean intentionally starting a fire somewhere else in order to contain this fire. So CFRA News following that story. Right now it's at Payden Road at Dwyer Hill Road. Fire started about an hour and a half ago. Dr. Barry Dworkin is with us here in the Hal Anthony studio. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility or 1-800-580-CFRA. If you have any health-related questions, and Dale, you're up first this afternoon. Go ahead, sir. Dale?
Hi.
Hi, Dale. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much. Dr. Dworkin?
Yes.
I had an MRI, and I don't have a GP, but I did go to the medical center at Charbot Lake, and Dr. Bell referred me to, orthopedic surgeon.
Okay.
Because there is something on my left wrist, but that's not important right now.
Mm-hmm.
When he got the MRI results, he said, I have inflammatory, and there were other words, and I didn't get them. My hearing is really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then that I have psoriatic arthritis.
Okay.
And it started in the left hand. It was red, swollen, inflamed. Then it went to my right hand. And now both hands are fine, except it's going up the nerves and the ligaments.
Mm-hmm.
I call them tendons. He called them ligaments.
Right.
So I presume he's right.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned that he was going to refer me to a
rheumatologist.
Rheumatologist. Yes. And that there would be three drugs, two of which I didn't get the word, but one of them was prednisone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last week I heard somebody on that had rheumatoid arthritis and possible lupus or whatever, and she said she's going to have a year wait. Can you tell me why this doctor that I went to wouldn't have given me one of these drugs to try? To stop the inflammation or to help or to try?
If there is a diagnosis of psoriatic arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease, psoriasis is not just doesn't just affect the skin. For some people, it can also attack the joints of the hand or migrate. So as you mentioned, it happened in your hands and now it's sort of resolved a bit. There are treatments that can be done, and prednisone certainly can be started by a family doctor if need be. The problem is how long you continue the prednisone. And there are also secondary blood tests that are usually done by the rheumatologist to further identify what disease process within the psoriatic arthritis is responsible for the damage, because treatments are usually tailored upon those results. Prednisone will usually mask a lot of things. It'll tend to reduce the inflammation. The blood levels for certain markers that they look for may normalize and make it more difficult for the rheumatologist to be able to identify exactly what treatment will work the best. But nevertheless, there are medications that can be used, and if someone has to wait a long time, one of the resources that we use as physicians, there's actually a couple. We would sometimes call a rheumatologist if the wait is a bit long, just to speak to them directly and say, look, these are the blood levels, this is what's going on. What would you recommend we start the patient with before they see you as a means of getting a head start? If that rheumatologist is not available, or say someone is in an outlying area where they don't have access to rheumatologist or to speak to someone, one of the resources we use is a web-based resource called UpToDate.com. There's a professional aspect to it where you can log in. It's not a commercial site. It's more deals with evidence-based medicine. And if indeed the diagnosis is psoriatic arthritis, it will provide the basic and more detailed background on how to treat it and what to use, so that if a rheumatologist is not readily available, you are following standard guidelines for care and doing the appropriate follow-up. So I would still push for trying to see the rheumatologist as soon as possible. But that being the case, the answer to your question is that physician certainly could prescribe medications to treat it if they're comfortable doing it. That's the other thing. The physician has to be comfortable with being able to treat that condition. And if they're not, then they have to be forthright and say, look, I'm not comfortable treating it, because they don't want to do a patient harm either. It's something where they have to meet their own level of ability and not exceed that ability if they're not comfortable doing that.
Okay, we'll stop here and we'll pick it up with more of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin right after the news at 3:30 here on 580 CFRA. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday house call on 580 CFRA, and our phone lines are wide open right now at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, free phone call. And a free long-distance call as well, toll-free anywhere in North America, 1-800-580-CFRA. Up next is Alan. Go ahead, Alan.
Yes, I've gotten the meningitis and the hepatitis vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some new ones out, and I'm wondering what the doctor thinks about getting those. There's tetanus, pneumonococcus, shingles, and varicella. There's those four that apparently you can get vaccinations for them now.
Well, tetanus is actually a very old vaccine. It was brought out many decades ago. So it's something that's routinely given, usually every 10 years to adults. Included with that is usually diphtheria and tetanus combined. They're called TD boosters.
Okay.
Varicella or Varivax, which is a vaccine for chickenpox, also has been around for about 30 years. Started vaccinations in Japan and then brought into the United States and then Canada. And that vaccine is given to infants at 15 months of age as part of their routine vaccination schedule.
Usually, what about adults?
It's given to adults if a blood test is done and shows that they have not been exposed to chickenpox in the past. They're given that vaccine to protect them because chickenpox in adults is a much more serious infection with more complication rates than you see with infants.
So I've probably been exposed, and that's not the one to
worry
about.
Yeah, most people by the age of 20, the rate is about 95% of all people 20 years of age, by the time they reach 20, have been exposed to chickenpox or have been vaccinated for it because it has been around for a long time.
What about shingles and pneumococcus?
Yeah, pneumococcal vaccine also has been around for quite some time. The adult version is called Pneumovax. That contains 23 separate proteins that will protect against the same number of strains of pneumococcus or strep pneumonia bacteria, and usually is given to people who have who've had either severe illness, so they're either immunocompromised or they've had spleen removed, they have diabetes, kidney diseases, or they're age 65 and older. It's used as a means of trying to help prevent that type of pneumonia, which can be a very severe pneumonia. Okay. For infants, there is a similar type of vaccine called Prevnar, which contains 13 strains, proteins protecting against 13 strains of the strep pneumonia bacteria. And for infants and children, strep pneumonia is one of the leading causes of ear infections and meningitis, so that's why that's given. With regards to the shingles vaccine, that is indicated for people age 60 and over. Seems to work best in people between the ages of 60 and 70. It is a weakened strain. It's a live virus. It's a weakened strain of chickenpox vaccine, which is what, if you get chickenpox earlier in life, you are at risk of developing shingles, actually at quite a substantial risk of shingles over your lifetime. And so what this vaccine does is it stimulates production of antibodies. It literally wakes up your immune system to remember that it had been exposed to chickenpox in the past. And so your antibody levels will increase and protect you from a reactivation of that virus. Because once you have chickenpox, that virus lies dormant in your body. It doesn't go away and can be reactivated at any time. And so that vaccine, they say over the age of 60, because what tends to be seen is that for folks as they get older, those antibody levels that protect you against reactivation of that virus tend to diminish with age, usually because it's been so long since you've been exposed to chickenpox, that the vaccine is given to boost up that immune system again, to boost up the antibody response so you don't, it reduces your risk of shingles. It's not perfect. People could still get shingles after the shot, but it still reduces the risk by about half to about 60-70%. So it's not too bad, and it's certainly a worthwhile thing considering we've had lots of callers. Rob, we had the gentleman last week who had that facial pain from shingles.
That's right, yes.
And just suffering from it. So it's certainly a worthwhile vaccine for people over the age of 60. It is costly. It's about $200 for the vaccine. It's one dose, but it is something that is available for people should they wish to receive it.
So of the four, you would recommend, the tetanus and the shingles, because I'm 60 years old.
Yeah, the shingles vaccine would certainly, if you've had chickenpox in the past, and you know that you've had chickenpox in the past, then shingles vaccine, and tetanus is in general given every 10 years anyway, so you should be getting that as a routine. And if you have no other outstanding medical conditions, then by age 65 is when you usually would get the Pneumovax vaccine.
On to another call, and Douglas, go ahead. You're on with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Douglas.
Okay. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Afternoon.
I'm giving you a follow-up. About last June, I told you about experiencing shortness of breath and lack of stamina, and
yes.
You suggested my thyroid and testosterone checked out, and right. those were all inside. Somehow I had overlooked at that point to mention to you that I had a pacemaker.
Okay.
I've been through a pile of tests and so forth from July to January, February, to mm-hmm. prove that my lungs were clear.
Right.
Then the respirologist is going to refer me to the Heart Institute. I said, no thanks. I've been down that road. I got my own cardiologist mm-hmm. Who referred me to the Heart Institute to replace my pacemaker from a one-wire to a two-wire.
Okay.
They called me last Wednesday. I have a cancellation at 9:20. I was in the institute prepped by 10:30, off the operating table just before 2 and released at 5:30, and I feel my strength coming back now.
Oh, that's excellent.
Wow.
That's excellent news.
The sad point was that all these specialists never thought to look at my pacemaker.
Right. Well, it's also history is very important, because if you don't provide that history, it gets very difficult to figure that out.
Well, I mean, they knew, these other people all knew
right.
I had the pacemaker.
Oh, right, okay.
But I didn't tell you.
Didn't tell me.
Yeah, and that would have led you probably down another path.
History
but,
is important.
Thank you for your patience and your...
You're welcome.
Yes.
Thank you, Douglas.
I'm glad you're feeling better.
Good news story there. Let's go to Margaret on line 3. Go ahead, Margaret.
Yes, hello, Doctor.
Hi.
On Sunday, I think it was your Sunday program.
Yes.
You had a listener who had dry skin, and you mentioned a soap that doesn't lather a lot, but
right.
very good for your dry skin.
Yes.
What was the name of it?
Oh, it's called Spectro Gel.
Spectro. How do you spell Spectro, it?
Spectro, S-P-E-C-T-R-O.
C-T-R-O.
G-E-L.
I'm sorry, the L you said?
G-E-L.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and it's designed for people who have eczema or very dry skin, and I'm sure there's other products out there that do similar things. It's
Spectro gel.
Yeah, it's the one that I tend to just okay. use. But again, I'm not pushing any particular product. But it does clean your skin, but it doesn't take out the oils from your skin as much as regular soap does, and that's especially important for people who have diseases such as psoriasis or eczema. Or other dry skin conditions, because
yes,
that can
see.
Only make that worse.
And can you buy that just about anywhere?
Oh yeah,
store?
Any pharmacy will have it, and you'll probably see other brands do the same thing right next to it on the shelf. So
I
it's
see.
Just a matter of finding one that you find that works best for
oh,
you.
Oh, very good. Okay, appreciate your help.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You for your call, Margaret. And this will be the last call for the Wednesday house call here on 580 CFRA. And Andrew, you're up next. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Doctor, I'm heading off to Cuba, to the North Coast,
yes.
in about 10 days. What a lucky man I am.
Say hi to Fidel for us.
Yes. I don't think he'll attend upon me. Anyway, the problem I've got is the area I'm going in has a lot of mangrove swamps. Malaria. I'm considering taking an anti-malaria, like I said, in about 12 days.
Right.
Any recommendations as to what I'm going to be seeing my physician? Any recommendations?
Well, usually you have to... For Cuba, I'm... For Cuba, I know in terms of vaccinations, there's no recommendations for anything more than what we have here. With regards to malaria, if they indeed have malaria there, you have to find out whether there are certain resistances to certain drugs. And so there is a website, iamat.org, iamat.org, that will have a PDF file that will list out, with regards to Cuba and other countries, whether any malaria prophylaxis or medication is necessary. I haven't heard of many people having to take medications for malaria when you're in Cuba, but again, you're going to a very specific area that may be swampy,
yeah.
so that in itself might be one of the reasons to doing that. The main medications that are usually used, chloroquine being one, but there's a lot of resistance in different areas. Another one that is used is called Malarone, which is taken on a daily basis for the duration that you're there, and also for a week after and 2 days before. So it's sort of, if you're there for a week, you usually take it for a total of 16 days, starting 2 days before you leave. Another
with
one.
With that latter one, what a number of people told me is that unlike the mefloquine or the other one you were mentioning, is it affects skin pigmentation. I have to watch it.
No, it doesn't really affect skin pigmentation. And the
okay.
other one, yeah, mefloquine or larium, which is usually taken once a week, is also another one. But again, in order to know which one to use or what recommendations there are, you have to look up on, and it's not in front of me right now, I'd be able to tell you, but from that site or even from the Centers for Disease Control, they will provide advice to travelers with regards to what medication is recommended, if any, when going to that specific region.
Okay, I'm just worried, once again, there is a big mangrove swamp in the area. Thank you very much, Doctor.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Barry Dworkin here for the Wednesday House Call. And he'll be back on Sunday, of course, Sunday at 4, with the Sunday House Call. And don't forget health headlines just before the 7 o'clock news, around 10 to 7 every morning here on 580 CFRA with Steve Madeley.